This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, as America's elite universities come under threat, one university president speaks out. The Trump administration is upending college campuses across the U.S. In recent weeks, the White House has launched investigations into dozens of the nation's universities, accusing these schools of anti-Semitism and threatening to freeze major federal grants if the schools don't comply with the administration's demands around things like admissions policies and DEI programs. The civil rights attorney who is leading the administration's task force to combat anti-Semitism, Leo Terrell, spoke to Fox News back in February.
We're going to use every tool in the toolbox, civil, criminal, activities to stop the harassment of Jewish students. That means we're going to take criminal action. We're going to cut off funding. We're going to do everything, and we're formulating that right now.
This week, Harvard became the first elite school to refuse the administration's demands. In response, Trump froze $2.2 billion in their funding. The Department of Homeland Security is also threatening to revoke Harvard's ability to admit international students unless the university hands over disciplinary records for any students who've participated in protests. It's worth noting that 27% of Harvard's student body is international students. As of Thursday, Harvard continues to say it will stand its ground. A handful of other schools have expressed solidarity. Now, by contrast, Columbia University was one of the first schools targeted, and it agreed to work with the administration, giving more power to security officers on campus to arrest people and changing the leadership of its Middle Eastern Studies Department, among other moves. But that wasn't enough to satisfy the Trump administration, which paused $400 million in funding anyway.
This overreach of the federal government isn't just about higher education. It's about the freedoms of civil society that we have enjoyed in this country since the founding.
That's Michael S. Roth, the president of Wesleyan, a small private university in Connecticut.
This White House is determined to make people align with the ideological preferences of the leader. And that's something we haven't seen in the United States, and we should reject it.
President Roth has been a vocal critic of Trump's attacks on colleges and universities. He pointed out that this is not only a moment when federal funding is on the line, but students' futures are too. The administration has been revoking international student visas, and in some cases, those students have been apprehended by ICE with no warning and held in detention facilities without any specific charges, and so far, at least, without due process.
The idea that these students are serious threats to the foreign policy of the United States is absurd. And what's really a threat to the foreign policy of the United States is when people see how inconsistent and how lawless the government's been acting.
I sat down with President Roth earlier this week to talk about what he's seeing in his role as a university leader, but also as an educator who's pushing back against what he believes is an existential threat to a fundamental tenet of America, academic freedom.
It's a really interesting moment for campus cultures. If you're an international student, I think you're likely to be very worried. I mean, is someone going to appear and abduct you and take you to Louisiana, which seems to be the place for detention? Or are you going to get your student visa canceled for no discernible reason? Most international students haven't been that political, but even the tough student who was arrested, I mean, she had co-authored an op-ed in the student newspaper. That hardly sounds like the lunatic fringe, you know? So there are people who are at risk, trans students as well, who feel that they are at risk. And then there are many other students who are just going about their business. They have a midterm next week and they're studying furiously, or they have an art show that's opening tomorrow. So if you're a person who's been targeted, it's a scary time. And for many other students especially, they're going about their college business as they would have in any other time.
I mean, you must think about this all the time, but especially right now when universities are under such scrutiny, what is the college campus for? What is college for? What is the purpose of it? How do you think it's meant to function at its best?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that question, because I've been a professor since the early 80s and, you know, the president for 20 years now. And I've been thinking a lot about what function a college has for different kinds of students in different parts of the country, different parts of the world. And I wrote a little book about this called The Student, A Short History. And my conclusion was that in the last really 150 years or so, being a student, especially in college level, came to mean that you had this license to practice freedom. You were encouraged to practice being free. And that meant you could study something you weren't sure was going to be useful. You could try your hand at, I don't know, ultimate frisbee or poetry or you know, any number of things. And also meet people that you're not sure you're going to like or you're going to agree with. And that you have this atmosphere where you're encouraged to practice being free, because that's how you learn skills that will be useful to you after graduation in the job market. But it's also how you learn how to be a human being who continues to learn well after your college years. And so that atmosphere of freedom, and it'll be different, you know, at the University of Iowa or University of Michigan than it is at a small place like Wesleyan or at an Ivy League school. Each school is different. But I think what they have in common is that the students have this space to practice being free people. And I think that campuses today still have that vibe, if I can use that word, of providing freedom and safety. But that's really being put under enormous pressure by the moves of the administration in an authoritarian direction.
Well, and one way that they're turning up that pressure is by making these threats about funding. Right? I mean, what's the fallout of all of this funding talk? Who loses out here?
Well, I think it's, you know, since the Second World War, at least, the government has recognized that by subsidizing research at big universities, and not only big universities, even Wesleyan, a small university, gets significant support for scientific research. But by subsidizing this research, the country as a whole benefits through the discovery of vaccines, through the discovery of new technologies that will be used in commerce, through the discovery of new drugs that can be used for the treatment of diabetes or cancer. And it's a terrifying prospect in a country where we have depended on innovations at universities to support more sophisticated healthcare, more sophisticated technology. And it's benefited us so much that it's a tremendous mistake to try to destroy that ecosystem for ideological reasons.
Why do you think the Trump administration is targeting these schools in this way? What do you think the goal is?
That's a great question, Shumita. I think it's really hard to tell sometimes. Sometimes the Trump administration just lurches in one direction and then lurches back in another direction. But I think that there has been some consistency in the campaign rhetoric and in the rhetoric of many Trump allies in their contempt for universities, especially those that are the most selective or that are called elite universities. And I think this is part of the populism of the Trump administration, although, of course, President Trump went to an Ivy League school, as did Vice President Vance and all the rest. But I think they see that most Americans are never going to have a chance to be at Wesleyan or Harvard or Yale. And so they're easy targets and I think makes us vulnerable to a populist resentment. Beyond that, I think universities and colleges have done a poor job of explaining what we do in our research and in our teaching in ways that are relevant to most Americans. We've been, you know, happy to be in our little bubble. Almost 10 years ago, I wrote something for the Wall Street Journal about how we need an affirmative action program for conservatives on college campuses. And
to diversify the kind of ideological thought on campuses. Right?
Yeah. Especially, yes, exactly. That, you know, many years ago when I was a student, we said, well, we need to have more women on the faculty. We're just a bunch of old guys. And they said, oh, well, we'd love to have more women, but we only hire the best. We can't just hire people because they're women. So when I said this about hiring more conservatives, my faculty said, well, we'd love to hire conservatives, but we only hire the best. And those people, they believe what I believe. And I pointed out how just prejudiced this sounded and how closed-minded we sometimes sound at colleges and universities, not taking conservative ideas seriously enough. And this is not true, of course, in the sciences. It's not relevant in math in the same way as it might be relevant in history or literature course. But I do think it was an important signal to the country that universities were giving that we're pretty happy with ourselves, even though we have this bubble. And that made us more vulnerable. This is not an excuse for the Trump administration's actions, which I think are really fundamentally irrational, but it is an explanation of why we've become more vulnerable than we should be.
Well, it seems like we're already in the thick of talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion in a way. So let's stay with this topic for a moment, because this is one of the points that the Trump administration has made, one of the demands it has made of schools when talking about withholding funding, is that they want to see universities change or really get rid of a lot of their diversity, equity, and inclusion programming or policies. And we have seen some schools respond to that by taking down language on their websites, modifying language that suggests that they're changing the way that they're thinking about DEI programs. How are you seeing this play out, responses from various schools? And how are you thinking about this at Wesleyan?
So I watch schools clean up their websites and fire lots of people who are doing DEI work, not because they think that work wasn't valuable, but because they're afraid of the government. And now you have a government that says, we're in favor of free speech. And because of governmental pressure, all these schools are watching out what words they use. You have a government that says it's in favor of freedom of thought and diversity of thought, and they just take books out of the Naval Academy library because the word diversity is in them, or because they're written by Black people. So some of this is just fundamentally racist nonsense. But their interpretation of civil rights law is saying, from our perspective, if you discriminate against any group, Black, white, brown, whatever, then you're a violation of civil rights law. That's the extrapolation from the affirmative action decision of the Supreme Court. And it seems to me that as someone who runs an institution in the United States, I am obligated to obey the law. I thought affirmative action was a good thing in admissions. The Supreme Court said that may be the case, President Roth, but you can't do it that way anymore. So we don't do it that way. And so we at Wesleyan have changed things like we used to have a prize for a woman filmmaker that was given by a donor, and we had to tell the donor, we can't do that anymore because someone said it discriminates against men, although we have other prizes that men typically win. Similarly, we had programs for little kids in Middletown, was where Wesleyan is located in central Connecticut. We had a program called Girls in Science to try to show girls in elementary school that, yeah, science is fun and you can, you know, not just for boys. Someone said, oh, but you're excluding boys. Now, of course, we thought boys had a lot of other opportunities, but we'll make it kids in science and still do what we want to do, which is to make science available to everybody. And I do believe that, although I disagree with that interpretation of the law, I'm not in charge, they are. So I think we have to follow the law. But I think we all know, whether you're running a combat platoon or an innovation lab at Google, that having people with diverse experiences, diverse backgrounds in the room makes it more likely that you'll have a significant innovation or you'll get something done. And so we continue to prize diversity, that is the having people with different opinions, with different life experiences. We also want everyone to feel they're given a fair shake. We also want everybody to feel they belong. But schools around the country that have just really dismantled their programs that provide access to the resources of the university to people who have not had access before, I think that's going too far in the direction of really retreating from the civil rights gains that the country has made in haltingly over the last several decades.
So it sounds like what I hear you saying is there is a bad faith argument that you hear the Trump administration making here about diversity of thought, which in actuality, what the administration is asking for is to move away from progressive liberal thinking and move towards something more conservative leaning. But I also hear you saying that there is a good faith argument to be made for diversifying thought on campuses.
Absolutely.
And I'll just say this as someone who's clearly sitting removed comfortably, sitting in the seat of a curious observer of all of this. You know, it's tough to find people who are willing to acknowledge the nuances here, because it does feel like when there is a grain of truth, it can be exploited.
Exactly. I think that's so right. And that's what happens in this hyper-polarized atmosphere. where people say, well, if you believe a little bit of X, then you have to also believe Y, Z, and all these other things, which are awful. And that's just not true. And I think as an educator, or as a teacher, my job is to show that's not true. So I teach what would have been traditionally called great books classes. You know, I have them read a lot of old stuff, but they also read, you know, contemporary critical race theory or Daniel Allen. But they read Aquinas, and they read Aristotle, and they read Machiavelli, and they read Jane Austen. And I often give them conservative interpretations of these texts, which they are unlikely to hear otherwise. And I began doing that because I had a friend who had been a trustee who used to point out to me when he was on campus all the things I took for granted as a progressive person, as a person on the left, that seemed to me common sense. And I thought, oh my gosh, if you look at it from his he's a libertarian. If you look at it from that perspective, I'm not indoctrinating people, but I'm not giving them a broad enough spectrum of views.
What kinds of things was he pointing out? I'm curious.
Well, here's an example that I'm embarrassed that it was surprising to me when I heard it. A guidance counselor from a high school said that if I have a student applying to a school like yours, a liberal arts college or Ivy League university, and you all say you want to see civic engagement in our applicants. He said, but if I have a student whose civic engagement was defending the rights of the unborn, it would be professional malpractice for me to let them put it in their application. I was shocked. And I said, no, that can't be true. And he said, you don't know. The admissions offices lean in a certain way. And so once I started hearing this, I convened a group of conservative students in my office to ask them if they felt beleaguered for if they felt pushed around for their political views, and how could I be helpful to them if they did. And I remember there was a libertarian kid who was very outspoken. And I said, do you feel like your professors are prejudiced against you? And he looked at me with a big smile and said, no, they find me fascinating. And I do think that most of the time, good teachers will want students to entertain views that are not the professor's views. No good teacher wants followers. You want people who are engaged in inquiry, not following. And I think we should broaden our inquiry.
Let's move on to another sticking point for the Trump administration when making these threats about withholding funding from universities, and that's been the pro-Palestinian protests on campuses.
Yes.
Secretary Rubio has characterized visa seizures, student visa seizures and visa revocations as a response to students expressing support for terror organizations like Hamas. How do you understand the dynamics of what's happening here?
I think this is a totally bogus explanation. I think they're trying to instill fear among international students on campuses. They're playing to the people who support Israel and hoping that they will be gratified by this kind of crackdown. It is, on the free speech level, disastrous. You're telling people that even though they're in this country legally, with all the rights of anyone else who lives here, that they are not allowed to speak their mind. I say all of that as someone who finds Hamas detestable, that the thuggery of the pro-Palestinian rulers over the last several years has been disastrous for those people. I've been critical of the Netanyahu government, but the viciousness of terrorism as practiced by Hamas is beyond description, really. And yet, if someone wants to say at Wesleyan campus, from the river to the sea, Palestine must be free, I am not going to have them arrested. We might have a conversation. We may not have a conversation. But it's the fact that Secretary Rubio doesn't like their politics is not an excuse for taking away their rights. Now, his argument is it's a privilege to be in this country, not a right. That's true. But once you're here, if you break the law, you can get deported. But if you have an opinion that the Secretary of State disagrees with, that's not a threat to national security. The threat to national security is becoming a country that people from other countries are afraid to visit. You know, America profits so much from international students, and we have...
Sure. I mean, they often pay full tuition, for one thing.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, they come from all over the world. Why? Because the universities are great. The best universities of the world are in the United States. That's why all these people come here. And so if you are going to now make it much riskier for families to send their children here, they'll go to Australia, they'll go to England, they'll go to other places where they can study. And that's a great disservice to this country, culturally, economically, scientifically, educationally. It makes no sense except to energize the base to say, we're anti-terrorists. I'm an anti-terrorist, but that doesn't mean I have to be anti-free speech. Mm. And the brutality with which this is being done. I mean, it used to be if you had a visa problem, they just send you right home. Now they detain you in a cell. And there's, I mean, these stories circulate among families that were thinking about sending their kids to America. And, you know, why would they risk it? They know their kid isn't a terrorist, but since the federal government's just looking at people's phones and looking at pictures they don't like, why would you risk it? Mm. And so I think Secretary Rubio is actually harming U.S. foreign policy interests more than any of the people he's detained. And that's a shame. That's a shame. This is a person who, Marco Rubio, who advocated very strongly on behalf of the immigrants that he likes, right? The anti-Castro Cubans who protested in favor of free Cuba. These are people he loves, you know? But because if he doesn't like that they're protesting for free Palestine, he gets to deport them. Mm. It's absurd.
And I mean, just to say, around the time of so many student protests happening last spring, you were very outspoken about how you saw your role as leadership at your university in responding to protests that were happening at Wesleyan. And you wrote even about how you didn't particularly agree with some of the pro-Palestinian protesters' demands or the ways what they were asking for, divestment, for example, that you still supported their right to protest in the way that they were protesting at your university. Can you talk a little bit about how you saw yourself, how you positioned yourself with your students at that time?
It was a tense time, but it was a time that never degenerated into an atmosphere of violence. Mm-hmm. And so I thought they deserved the protection of the university, but they didn't deserve the agreement of the university. In other words, as long as they were articulating a position within the time and place restrictions that we have, that they could continue to do so. And they were vigorous protesters, but they also said, okay, we know it's almost finals, and so we're not going to protest after 9 p.m., and we're not going to block any doors. And so in the spring, I wrote a piece for the New Republic, and they entitled it, "This President Won't Call the Police on His Own Students," which is a little bit of a misnomer, actually. I didn't want to call the police, but I also said that I would call the police if I had to, you know, we have had crime on campus and years ago, and I got to know the police well because we needed them and they were helpful. This fall, there were some protesters, this very small group, who took over a part of a building, a conference room. And we told them, you can't do that. You can't just take over and make this your own part of campus. If you want to protest outside, you can do it. And eventually I called the police because we're not going to have people say, this space is just for us and you can't disagree with us. You can't go through. We weren't going to do that. And so we did call the police and then they did leave. And there were people at Wesleyan who were angry at me for calling the police, but I thought I was being pretty consistent. Mm. Not pretty. I was being consistent saying,
yeah,
you have a right
line
to protest.
It can be crossed.
But this is the line.
Right.
And I think I hope it's for protesters. They say it's respectful. If you cross the line, I am going to respect that you want to be arrested. And that's civil disobedience. But there are consequences. And you may get kicked out of school. But there is a line. And almost all the time, Wesleyan students respected that line. And when they didn't, there were consequences. And I think that was true at many schools. I was very moved to see people protesting the American support for atrocities in Gaza. I was proud that the students weren't just like worried about the next Frisbee match or the next baseball game, that this was something happening that was extraordinarily important and that they were going to bear witness to it. And although we disagreed about a lot of how you should best respond to it, I was proud that they weren't complacent. Mm. And I hope in the coming months and in the coming year that students also defend their schools against the government's overreach with the same energy that they expressed over the war in Gaza.
I mean, the Trump administration has created a task force to examine incidents at schools where pro-Palestinian protests were seen to have intimidated Jewish students, seen to have been harassing of Jewish students. Do you think that there is some good work to be done in this area? Again, this is kind of getting back to that idea of, I don't even want to call it a grain of truth here, because there's a real truth. It's not just a grain, but the exploitation of that truth possibly happening.
Yeah, it's the exploitation of that truth. The guy who runs that task force just recently talked about withdrawing someone's Jew card because this is a Jew that they don't like. If they had as much energy about anti-Semitism on the right, anti-Semitism in the neo-Nazi groups and paramilitary groups that have supported the Trump administration, I would take it more seriously. But this is not about protecting Jews. This is about getting colleges and universities to align with the ideology of the leader. The Germans have a word for this. It's called Gleichschaltung. It means coordination. Everybody should be coordinated with the leader. And this is so un-American and such a threat to our basic freedoms. And one of the most out Jewish presidents of a secular institution in the United States, I find it extremely distressing to see the legitimate efforts to stamp out anti-Semitism joined to these other efforts to actually make people align with the ideology or the whims of the leader. I think it's really an abuse of anti-Semitism, and that we should be very wary of it. The same people who are backing the administration on this are people who say that Leo Frank got what he deserved when he was lynched by an angry mob. These are the same people who talk about Christian nationalism being the real core ideology of the MAGA movement. I go back to the teachings of the rabbis. Beware of a government that pretends to be your friend, because if they don't use laws, they don't use principles, they can turn into your enemy very quickly.
Mm-hmm. You are one of the more outspoken university leaders in this moment about what you see as the real dangers coming from all of these actions and threats. I mean, what do you see as your risks for speaking out?
It's a great question. People keep asking me, which makes me very nervous, because I've been speaking out, you know, as long as they give me a microphone. And so I think at this moment, it seems like I'm speaking out more because other people aren't speaking out so much. I guess there's some risk involved, but I really don't think I'm saying anything radical or outlandish. I'm defending good old American freedoms of association, of speech, of religion, against governmental overreach. This is a great tradition. You know, I'm 68 years old. I've been a professor since 1983. I mean, I would be ashamed of myself if I didn't speak out. And by speaking out, I hope to have good conversations like the one we're having now and that I learn from them. But I think that this is a dangerous time for America. Our freedoms are being eroded. And they're being eroded in the classic way. You pick on a marginalized group like trans people, and then you pick on a group that a lot of people don't like because they're elitist, like an Ivy League university. This is a kind of playbook we've seen in authoritarian regimes. And if we don't point that out, then it just becomes much easier for the authoritarians to win. And I can tell you, I talk to my fellow presidents from time to time. I try to get them to sign things and things like that. And they will, I think, eventually. I'm not saying anything they don't agree with, as far as I could tell. But there are a lot of pressures on people to not speak out. I enjoy this longevity at Wesleyan, and I have a very supportive board. And I have this, you know, I was a Wesleyan student in the 70s. I was one of those protesters that many other people probably said, you know, you should lock that guy up. I think there's a tradition of trying to bear witness, speak your mind, listen to other people. And if that puts me at risk, the very fact that someone would say, are you not at risk for speaking your mind? Like, where are we? This is America. If I'm at risk for speaking my mind, that shows you that this authoritarianism is real.
Yeah. I have one last quick question for you, Michael, which is, I just imagine looking at the calendar that you might be starting to think about what you're going to say at commencement, starting to think about what your message is to the graduating class this year. What is your message to those who are graduating, those students who are still on campus and have maybe another few years left. What's your message to young people right now?
Don't take freedom for granted. These are kids who were in high school during COVID, and they were subject to all kinds of restrictions, and they've been battered by lots of troubles in the economy and in the country's political environment. My message is going to be, don't take freedom for granted. Defend the freedoms that make it possible for us to learn together, that make it possible for us to worship the way we want to worship, to write the things we want to write, to have the kind of friends we want, to fall in love with the people we fall in love with. Defend those freedoms, because we now see that some people really want to take them away from us.
President Roth, it was a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for your time.
Very nice to speak with you. Thank you very much.
Michael S. Roth is the president of Wesleyan University. For more on how universities are handling the federal government's threats, we've queued up a narrated article from The New Yorker to play for you next. If you're listening in the podcast app, you can find it by searching for Apple News Plus Narrated.